Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Welcome back. 2 weeks till our next pop-up stories event. We'll be discussing the birds and the bees, however you want to discuss them, at the Robin Theater in Lansing. 2 weeks from tonight, 6 to 7:30 p.m. If you have a story that involves the birds and the bees, join us. Visit our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing, and get in touch. If you just want to come and listen to the stories, that's fine as well. What some people are calling the restroom revolution in North Carolina is refueling an ongoing national debate over LGBTQ rights. But unisex restrooms are only part of a larger civil rights movement underway in America. It was standing room only yesterday as more than 100 people packed the Michigan Department of Education headquarters in Lansing. They had come to comment on the State Board of Education's proposed recommendations for creating what it terms a safe and supportive learning environment for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and questioning students. The board's grappling with a number of issues, from including LGBTQ topics as part of school curriculum to restroom accommodations. Board members say whatever they come up with will be offered as a set of guidelines and not a mandate. My colleague Kevin Lavery joins me now in the studio with more on this developing issue. Kevin, you witnessed some of the public comment period. Tell us a little more about it.
I did, Mark. I was there at the start of the comment period, and then I left after I gathered a handful of interviews, which you'll hear. But this really was a marathon session that stretched on for several hours yesterday. As you noted, the proposed recommendation before the board covers a lot of ground. It talks about creating and enforcing anti-harassment policies, providing staff professional development opportunities. It even talks about ensuring that school libraries contain information about LGBTQ issues. At the hearing, I met two teachers who are also a married couple. Jennifer and Andy Robinson live in the Kalamazoo area, but they did not come yesterday as teachers. You see, Jennifer and Andy have a four-year-old named Gracie. Actually, that's the name she's given herself. Gracie was born Benjamin. Jennifer, Andy, and I found ourselves talking near a noisy service elevator outside the boardroom. The Robinsons are already trying to prepare for Gracie's future as a transgender student.
Initially, we thought it was a phase, and we thought that, you know, she was young, and you let little children play with the things that they want to play with, and as long as they're happy, then, you know, it's a phase and it'll pass. Over time, it became clear to us that it wasn't a phase, and she began to get very adamant and defiant about us calling her Ben and calling her he and things of that nature. And so when we did a little bit more research and kind of asked around and asked some experts, they suggested that this might be the possibility, and we knew that that's what was going on and that's what was right for her.
And she picked her own name, Gracie?
We gave a list of some unisex names that were, you know, applicable for boys or girls, and then we let her choose out of that list.
Andy, tell me about the mental transition that you and Jennifer had to go through once you realized this was the course that she was on, that, you know, the decisions you started to have to make about her future.
It was a tough process because, you know, our biggest concern was her well-being, but once it kind of became clear that this was the road we were going down, we wanted to make sure we weren't pushing anything on her or that we weren't holding her back. So it just became a process of, you know, educating ourselves and seeking out anybody that we could find to help us with this process. I mean, even today, that's been a great part, is just being able to network with people, you know, who share our experiences or who have resources that can help us when we get to that point, because that's what it's all about right now, is just finding the resources so we can give her the, you know, the best chance that we can.
Gracie is four, so she will be starting kindergarten, is it this coming fall?
Yes.
Has she been through a preschool or any kind of a socialized setting before?
Yep, she's been in preschool and daycare settings since birth.
And how have her peers received her?
The peers, at first, the biggest difference for them was really just the name adjustment, but she had always gone to, you know, the first stop at daycare was the dress corner, and on with the princess dresses and the bride's dresses, and her best friends there were female, and so the behavior didn't really change. She was still who she was. We just were calling her by different pronouns and a different name, but they didn't miss a beat.
Obviously, this is just a hearing phase, but it seems like if anything does happen, it could be good timing for Gracie to start kindergarten. What are you hoping for in terms of an outcome?
Long term, my hopes for the outcome would be that we don't have to have this conversation anymore, that it just is part of how we handle students, and it's just one more thing that we routinely do and plan for. for Gracie in particular, I feel thankful and fortunate that it is taking place at a time when this conversation is being had, and we're not having to be secretive about it, and we're not trying to overcome, you know, overt and blatant discrimination.
What's on your mind about this, Andy?
Well, I think it's just that we just want her to be in an environment where she's accepted, and we don't have to fight the discrimination the entire way through.
So Andy Robinson mentioned finding resources to help Gracie and themselves navigate this reality. Is that already happening, Kevin?
It would seem so. I don't know how many people they have reached out to so far, but while I was there, Jennifer and Andy Robinson were approached by a pediatrician who did express her support for them. As they said, the Robinsons certainly do not want Gracie to grow up as a target of discrimination, but of course, sadly, that does happen, and it did happen to a young woman that I met there at the hearing. Kate Fessler is from Canton. She left Michigan a couple of years ago for college, but she remembers all too well her school days in Michigan and what it felt like when she realized that she was a lesbian.
So I spent 12 years in the Michigan public school system, and it was a very difficult 12 years for me, especially when I reached a point where I started to realize that I might not be straight. And when I heard about the guidelines, I was very excited because I know that they could be an amazing thing for our school system and for LGBTQ youth. So when I heard about these hearings and I had heard that there was some backlash against the guidelines, I thought that hopefully, you know, if I could just kind of tell my story and what had gone on with me, that that might help make it so that the school board would be able to put a face to the students who struggle in schools, and it might help kind of, yeah, it might help.
Have you had personal struggles with your own identity in terms of your peers and your fellow students?
Yes, I definitely have. The story that I told in front of the school board was about when I was in eighth grade. My best friend found out I was gay and told everyone at school, and no one would talk to me by the end of the year. And then when I was in 12th grade, I had finally come out, and I was out. I was one of the very few out students at my high school. And an editorial came out that was anti-gay marriage in my school newspaper, and I was one of the few people that was very easily targeted with comments and slurs and a lot of bullying kind of throughout my public school education.
How long have you been out of high school?
I'm now about to be a junior in college, so I just completed my sophomore year.
And how do you think the tone is now that you're in college? Society's tone, do you think it's changed at all and is a little more sympathetic to people like you now?
I think that to some extent it is. I think that it really depends on where you are geographically. I go to school in Massachusetts, and I found that out there it's much less of a big deal. When people find out that I'm gay, it's kind of a, oh, that's nice. And, you know, it's not a problem for anyone. So that makes it kind of difficult when I come home, because while there are a lot of people in my life who are very affirming and who are very supportive, I do also run into people who, you know, stare at me in the grocery store or whisper things, and that can be very difficult. But I think overall, hopefully the trajectory that our society is moving in is a much more accepting one.
And what the Board of Education is doing, that does not affect you directly. You're already out of Michigan's public schools. That would have no real direct bearing on your life, yet you still felt compelled to give your testimony. What brought you to that decision?
I think that for our community, youth is a huge part. You know, making sure that they feel safe in their schools is huge. It's very important so that we can have LGBTQ adults who can grow up and can look out for the youth. And to be a part of that is very important to me. I also have 5 younger brothers and sisters who are all in the Michigan public school system. And my family is mixed race. It's very, very important to me that no one, for any reason, be bullied or feel like they are unsafe at school.
So Kate Fessler has an interest in seeing the state adopt an inclusive LGBTQ policy. Was there much opposition at the hearing, Kevin?
Indeed, there was. There were a handful of protesters outside the building when I arrived. Some of them, Mark, were with a group called the Bible Nation Society. That's a group based in Michigan that claims to be affiliated with some 16,000 churches across the United States. I met its founder and director, Douglas Levesque. He had just testified against the proposal, which he feels came together in a less than open manner.
We feel like they've been, frankly, produced somewhat in secrecy. And then secondly, that they not only don't represent a majority of Christians. Michigan, historically and today, is about 85% identifies Christianized. And we believe that the State Board of Education is practicing an advocacy of sorts that really is against our way of life and our mindset. So we felt like we needed to show up and just tell the board that we felt that this was a political issue that probably should be left more to legislators. I think maybe they want to give voice to, you know, the issues of real people who are struggling. We're certainly sympathetic to that. The Christian faith loves souls. Every soul has sin, has error. And so we try to approach all those with love.
What would you say, though, to those who may say, morality issues aside, this is an issue of public safety, of finding a place where LGBTQ students can be safe from intimidation, violence?
Right, exactly. You know, obviously, we don't advocate violence towards somebody who's different at all, and so it's foolish to say that. But they're the ones bringing out the statistics saying that LGBTQ students have greater mental illness, troubles at home, troubles at school, troubles at violence. It's like advocating a refugee crisis. We're advocating this. We're saying, and now we want to promote, you know, prepubescent children to take their puberty and then question their gender. The idea of gender identity is not a medical issue, it's a psychological issue. They admit that. And they're wanting an adaptation of society, an adaptation that we disagree with and that we don't want. And so, understandably, there are issues to deal with, but we don't think that advocating policy through the Board of Education is the right thing to do.
So what should these students do who feel caught in the middle?
Well, you know, there are 250,000 private parochial homeschool students in the state of Michigan. The state of Michigan provides online education for them for free. That doesn't count the many charter schools students that are out there as well that public funding is going to. Half of all tax revenues are going to the Michigan Board of Education, and yet black graduation rates are second worst in the nation. Hispanic graduation rates are third worst in the nation. We need to be focusing on those issues. This, frankly, is not a school issue. It should be maybe a law enforcement issue. It should be a parental rights issue. It should be a legislative issue. But this is not for the Board of Education to dictate policy when we come to, you know, 4,000 years of the Judeo-Christian ethic.
Again, even if it comes down to a safety argument, a legal accommodation argument.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. We're not saying that there's not obstacles to overcome, but we don't think that pushing absolute acceptance and then additional fundings when we don't have enough funding as it is the way to go.
It was a very full day of testimony, Kevin. Lots of passion on both sides. What happens now?
Well, the public comment period ends at close of business today. The State Board of Education expects to sift through about 15,000 comments. State Superintendent Brian Whiston says this process will take a while. He says the earliest that the board may take any action at all will be in August. And Mr. Whiston was adamant that this will be a very public process with a lot of transparency built in.
We will keep an eye on it. Current State's Kevin Lavery. Thank you, Kevin.
My pleasure, Mark.
This year's Rio Summer Olympic Games will rekindle memories for many in mid-Michigan. 4 years ago, the Lansing area became transfixed when DeWitt gymnast Jordan Weber competed in the London Games, winning a gold in team gymnastics. The year before, the 20-year-old was crowned world champion in all-around competition. Last year, Jordan Weber announced her retirement from elite gymnastics to focus on college. She's been studying psychology at UCLA. Last summer, on a visit back home, I spoke with Jordan Weber about her life after competitive gymnastics. I first asked how she felt after announcing her retirement.
It's been a really different experience. I mean, ever since I was four, I've been doing gymnastics, competing, training 30 hours a week. So it definitely was a big transition for me going from training all the time, just having my whole life consumed by gymnastics to, you know, being an actual normal person and a normal college student. It's the craziest transition, but I've actually really enjoyed it. I'm going to college at UCLA, and I've just been focusing on school and doing a little bit of traveling here and there still, you know, doing other fun things like that. But it's been a big change, but I'm really enjoying it.
You've become the team student manager for the UCLA gymnastics team. You're enjoying that?
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I mean, it was, ever since I can remember, my two big goals were to go to the Olympics and to be a college gymnast. And I really had my heart set on that. But when I got the opportunity to go professional in gymnastics, I thought to myself, I still kind of want to go be a part of a college team in some way. So that's why UCLA was my dream school, and I definitely wanted to still be a part of the gymnastics team there. So that's why I took on that role, and I get to be in the gym every day with them and help them kind of use my experience and knowledge in the gymnastics world to kind of help the team. And, you know, I've become really close with a lot of the girls on the team, and they're, you know, they were my first friends when I got to college. So it's been a lot of fun, and I really enjoy being a part of that team.
You've definitely raised the bar on being a student team manager. It's probably not too many Olympians who are student team managers. How do you like California?
I love it. I mean, it's very, very different than Michigan, where I'm from. But, you know, of course, there's the beach 5 miles away from UCLA. So that's not a bad thing at all. But there's just a lot to do. I mean, on top of school, you know, you can go hiking, you can go to the beach, and you can do lots of different things. And I have the free time to do that. So it's been really fun to live in California.
Remind us what you felt your professional options were 6 months or so ago. I mean, how long could you have competed? How long could you have performed? And what were your options?
Well, I mean, of course, a lot of people know that after the Olympics, I went back in the gym and I started training again. And my goal was to, you know, get back in shape and begin competing again, hopefully make the national team again. And then there was that ultimate goal of making the 2016 Olympics. But as I was training, I realized, you know, I did want to start college, and I did want to kind of move on to the next chapter of my life. And I went to UCLA at the beginning, and I started training there. But I started to realize it was tough to balance, you know, college classes and training. And you know, I just kind of realized that I was ready to move on. Not only had I been dealing with injuries my whole career, and it was a long road. And I just kind of sat down and looked at everything that I accomplished. And I was world champion and Olympian, and I just realized that I accomplished all of my goals. And it was time, and I was ready to move on and just kind of turn the chapter in my life and experience new things.
It felt right.
It did. You know, at first it felt weird because I could not even picture my life without gymnastics, going to practice every morning. So at first it didn't feel right, but now that I look back on the decision, it definitely feels right now.
We're talking with Jordan Weber, DeWitt's Olympic gold medalist, who competed on the American women's gymnastics team at the 2012 Games in London. Do you have a fitness routine now?
I do. And I think talking about transitioning from gymnastics, that was one of the biggest things. You have to find other ways to stay fit other than doing 7 hours of gymnastics every day. So I do a lot of, I do a little bit of running, some spinning classes, and I still go in the gym and sometimes flip around just for fun sometimes. But it is fun to just kind of explore all the different workouts and everything.
It is coming up on 3 years since the Olympics. How often do you think back on the games?
All the time. I definitely, those moments that I had in London with my team are things that I'll never forget. And I still think about it all the time. And I actually keep my medal at home in Michigan. So every time I come back to visit, like right now, I always look at it, and it reminds me of all those experiences that I had at the games and how amazing that all was.
So which single experience do you flash back on most often?
Definitely the team competition. It was an experience like no other, and I just remember walking into that arena and feeling so confident in my team and myself and just wanting to win that gold medal so bad. And we were so prepared for that. We had practiced all of our lives for that moment. And just to go out there and be able to relax and trust in our training and go out there, I don't remember being stressed at all during that competition. I remember just having fun and really enjoying it and cheering on my teammates. And we just did our job, and we went out there. And to be able to represent your country and win a gold medal for your country, that was quite the experience. And that's definitely the moment I look back on the most.
As impressive as the athletic accomplishment is, I'm almost as impressed with the mental dimension of what you do, of being a great athlete. How would you describe your mental approach to competition or to practice even?
Well, most people will tell you that gymnastics is probably 80% mental and 20% physical. It is the amount of mental strength that you need to have in order to compete on a big stage like that. It's crazy, you know. To be able to go out there and perform and do your best when the time counts, it's definitely something that takes a lot of practice. And I was just, yesterday I was doing a clinic with a bunch of little gymnasts, and they asked me, how do you deal with your nerves at a competition? And I told them one of the biggest things that I had to do was train my mind to make practice feel like a competition and to make competition feel like practice. So it's kind of funny when you think about it, but it's all about just training your mind and closing your eyes and visualizing your routines every night and just rehearsing it over and over again, sometimes just in your mind, because that can be more powerful than actually practicing the routine sometimes.
So visualization is a part of your
yes.
routine. Jordan Weber is our guest here on Current State on WKAR. Mm-hmm. You are incredibly skilled in a variety of gymnastics separate events. You were world champion in the all-round in 2011. But is there an event, a single event, that you were always just even a little bit more excited to compete in than the others?
I definitely really enjoyed competing on floor. I think that's the one event you just get to go out there and not only perform what you've been practicing, but you just get to kind of entertain the crowd and smile and just kind of make the, like, really bring the judges into your choreography and your routine and perform. And it's one of those things you can just put all your energy into it and just have fun. And so I really enjoyed competing floor. But, you know, another favorite event of mine was beam. I always thought there was so many skills to learn on beam that it was always a challenge, and I really enjoyed that challenge every day in the gym. But definitely floor was my favorite to compete.
How are you getting through this period where you have less competition, though? Are you investing that in the UCLA team then? Or, I mean, how are you getting that out of your system now?
It definitely is hard to get used to. I mean, for my whole life, I had these, like, very concrete goals of this is the next competition, this is the goal, and I always had that really major goal of going to the Olympics in the back of my head. So once all that is over, it's kind of hard to get used to not having those goals in my head, so I kind of have to set goals in other ways. You know, what can I do to help the UCLA team to the best of my ability? You know, I kind of have to transform those goals into school. You know, I really want to do my best in school, you know, to learn. I'm majoring in psychology, so I'm hoping to take what I learned there to kind of help me with my career and with the team. So it's all just about, you know, setting new goals for myself, because I don't have those gymnastics type goals anymore.
During the Olympics, you were actually competing with a stress fracture in your right leg. How did you manage to work through that?
I think I just thought to myself, you know, it took me so long to get to the Olympics, and I trained my whole life for this one moment. I wasn't going to give up that easy, you know. It wasn't, it was something that I could work through the pain. I obviously couldn't train as much as I wanted to. I had to take a little bit off of the tumbling and the pounding of my leg during training while we were in London, but of course I wasn't going to give up, and I was going to push through it. And to be honest, when I was out there on the competition floor, a lot of my adrenaline just took over, and I didn't really feel the pain, so that was great, and I'm really glad that I pushed through it. And as soon as the games were over, I put a boot on my leg and let it heal, so it was definitely worth pushing through the pain.
Is there one moment that stands out to you as being the highlight of your career?
Definitely. I mean, obviously the Olympics, winning that gold medal, just because I went through so much adversity and a little bit of disappointment not making it to all-around competition, and to go out there and 2 days later and win a gold medal for my country and with my team, I think that was definitely one of the best moments of my career. And then also the year before, becoming world champion and just saying that at that moment, I was the best gymnast in the world. I mean, that was amazing, and I can't believe I accomplished that. But it was just kind of a combination of all my hard work just paid off in that moment. And same thing with the Olympics.
It's really exciting just to hear you talk about it. It's great to have you here. We're talking with Jordan Weber, DeWitt's Olympic gold medalist, who competed on the American women's gymnastics team at the 2012 Games in London and was world champion. Now that you're out of it, though, you can do some things you weren't able to do before. You couldn't ski because of your gymnastics career. Have you skied yet?
I have not. I mean, I moved to California, so I don't really have the snow anymore, but hopefully someday I'll try skiing again. I definitely want to.
If you could pick what you'd be doing in 5 years, Jordan, what do you think it would be?
Ooh, tough question. Definitely after college, I'm hoping to go to grad school. So hopefully going to graduate school, and you know, a big goal of mine is to continue giving back to the gymnastics community and traveling around. And you know, one of my passions is motivational speaking. So hopefully I'll be able to do some more of that in the future. And maybe in 5 years, I'll be traveling around doing some motivational speaking, not only for little gymnasts, but for all types of people. So.
Do you like California enough that you see yourself still in California in 5 years?
I do. Yeah, I definitely want to stay in California. It's a lot of fun there.
DeWitt's Olympic gold medal gymnast Jordan Weber there recorded last year. An update, soon Jordan Weber expects to become an undergraduate assistant gymnastics coach at UCLA, and she plans to participate in a post-Olympics performance tour. One stop is currently planned for Michigan. She also hopes to attend the Rio Olympics later this summer and to graduate from UCLA next year. Coming up on Current State, we'll go back in time to study the history of Detroit's infamous Prohibition-era crime organization. Current State's Peter Wharf speaks with the Detroit author of the book, Off Color, The Violent History of Detroit's Notorious Purple Gang. That and more after the break on Current State. Current State, three times every weekday on WKAR, 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 90.5 FM, and every day at noon on AM 870. We're always at WKAR.org. The Listening Ear in East Lansing is the oldest operating all-volunteer crisis hotline in the country. Since 1969, it's been providing free telephone and walk-in counseling to clients in crisis. For this week's Neighbors in Action on Current State, we're joined by two volunteer crisis counselors at the Listening Ear. Ian Jacobs is Recruitment and Orientation Director. Welcome back, Ian.
Thanks for having me.
And Carly Geraci is Media Liaison Director. Carly, welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
Ian, how does the Listening Ear define crisis? What are the parameters of a crisis?
So we have a really broad definition of crisis. Our definition is any situation where normal coping mechanisms don't work. So that can be very different for many different people, and it can look different for everyone.
What are some of the more common reasons people seek you out?
We definitely have some set things like substance abuse, suicide, sexual assault, grief, things like that.
Is it ever, I mean, it's, I always think about work like this, and I always think this must be nerve-wracking to answer these calls. The phone rings and you can't be sure what the person on the other end is going through. Do you acclimate to that? Do you feel you train your people well enough that they can contend with that, or is anxiety for your volunteers ever an issue?
It's definitely our first few shifts. It can be very scary because, like you said, you don't know what you're going to expect. It can be anything, but we do have we have a 65-hour training program, and it trains us for almost any situation that you could encounter on the phones. So while it is nerve-wracking the first few times, I think you do pretty fast realize that it's not as scary as you anticipate.
Carly, your title is Media Liaison Director, but have you worked as a counselor on the phone?
Yes, yeah.
And walk-in? What's the hardest part of the job in terms of being a counselor?
I would say, kind of just like generally not knowing what to expect when you answer the phone. I guess personally, the hardest part would the fear of not being able to connect with them on an empathetic level in a way that we'd be able to help them would probably be like the hardest part. But like Ian said, the training really does prepare you for kind of like any situation that you would encounter. So even if you haven't like personally been through an experience that the caller may have been through, you can kind of empathize with the emotions that they're feeling at the time.
Mm-hmm. There must have been, since 1969, the Listening Ear's been doing this, there must have been occasions when you just had to put somebody down and seek help from somebody else. How often does something like that happen?
I guess kind of just like also depending on the person. Are you talking specifically about us volunteers, like having to put down the phone and
stuff?
No,
exactly.
Yeah. Well, the volunteers at the Ear are very supportive, and we're all also empathizing with each other, like after we hang up the phone, because the calls can get tough and it can get intense at times. But at the end of the day, we're like all there for each other.
65 hours of training, though, that's not insignificant. That is quite a bit of training. What's covered in those 65 hours, Carly?
In the training, we do a lot of role playing. So as you can imagine, we have like people who have been on training, have gone through training for that particular reason, that would kind of act out what a call might be like. And so it's heavily role play, lectures from professionals in the field and volunteers that have been there for a long time.
Carly Geraci is Media Liaison Director of the Listening Ear in East Lansing, and Ian Jacobs is the Listening Ear's Recruitment and Orientation Director. Ian, after 65 hours of training, what are the criteria here that someone has to meet to actually be formally become a crisis counselor?
So there are a few areas we look at. Empathy specifically, that's our main tool while we're on the phones with people, is empathy. That's really how we connect with people and we support people. But we also look at people's ability to self-disclose, meaning how are they feeling, or can they self-disclose about past experiences? And they don't have to. Obviously, we don't require people to talk about what they've gone through, but especially their feelings. We want people, our volunteers, to be able to be very emotionally aware of how they're feeling and how their emotions affect them. And then we use a specific feedback model. So that's something we look at too. We take our criteria very seriously, but we also want to give people the chance to meet criteria. So as a training staff member, if I did see someone going through our training who I was worried about or worried that they weren't going to meet criteria, I want to give them every possible opportunity to fix whatever mistake they're making and be able to join our staff, because I really love the Listening Ear, and I love making sure everyone can be involved in it.
Do you find yourself in a position where you're trying to help someone become more empathetic? Someone wants to become a counselor, and you may have doubts whether they're empathetic enough to really fill that role.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the empathy model that we have specifically, we can teach, but I don't necessarily think you can teach someone to be empathetic. Mm. I think in a lot of people, it's innate, and it's something that we teach people to access, but we don't give to people, if that makes sense.
Mm. How often does your work involve a referral? Or how often does your work result, I'll say, how often does it result in a referral to a professional counselor?
Is that common? That can vary. We do have a referral system. We have someone who is our referral book director. So it varies call to call. It may not even be a professional counselor. It may be another organization in the area. And since we get calls outside of Michigan as well, so sometimes it involves us looking up on our computer or phone resources in Nevada for a caller or something like that.
How often do you feel an incident or a call from someone seeking help is resolved by you and your counselors? In other words, how often do they literally just need someone to talk to and really don't require any other assistance? Is that common?
Yeah. Sometimes people just need someone to be there in the moment, and we never hear from them again.
And you feel like you've resolved a serious issue in somebody's life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Again, I'm speaking with Ian Jacobs, Recruitment and Orientation Director for the Listening Ear in East Lansing. Also, Carly Geraci joins us. Carly is Media Liaison Director. Ian, how are you trained to handle callers who are dealing with assault or abuse? Are you obligated to report that?
No, we're not. We only, if somebody asked me to, on their behalf, call the police, I definitely would, but, we are not required or obligated to notify anyone. It's what the caller wants. Basically, I look at an assault as somebody had their power taken away from them. And so when I'm talking to them, I want to give them the power to make decisions for themselves. So if they decide that they don't want to report their assault, that's their choice, and that I want to give them the power to make that choice.
You've both expressed that volunteering with the Listening Ear has had a significant impact on your own lives. Carly, what has it done for you? How has it changed you?
It's kind of crazy. I've only been there for a couple months, but the Listening Ear has just kind of provided a space for me personally to explore feelings and be able to talk about them with people. I just find that it's hard to, like, in society, just to, like, empathize with people, talk about feelings. It's just not a common thing. Mm-hmm. And the listening ear, like, that's what we're all about. We want to talk about feelings, like, volunteer to volunteer. Like, we always like talking about how we're feeling, dealing with just general kind of anxiety issues has kind of been better because I'm more aware of it because of starting at the listening ear. And yeah, it's just been very helpful to for me to be more aware. And it also has helped me realize that I'm not alone. And there are lots of people out there struggling with.
Well, I would say there's no better way to get outside your own problems than listening to other people's problems.
Exactly.
And it's a lot of times it offers a great deal of context and perspective that just living in your own head will never, ever offer. Ian, what about you? How long have you been there?
I have been there since February of 2015, so 15 months now,
okay.
I think.
How has it changed you?
I think a lot, like Carly said, it's the first time in my life where feelings are celebrated and discussed and encouraged. Because like Carly said, in society today, I think oftentimes we're told don't have feelings or don't talk about them because your feelings aren't important or we don't have time for that. But the listening ear is completely opposite, and we're like, you have feelings, let's talk about them. Let's celebrate these feelings.
I'd like to ask both of you whether you've had a particularly memorable encounter with someone calling. Carly, you haven't been there too long. Is there one that rises to the top yet?
Yeah, I mean, without getting too specific, I don't want to breach our confidentiality.
Of course.
But pretty much with any caller, I try to, like, put myself in their situation. That's kind of, like, the basis of empathy. And I remember kind of in the beginning of the conversation, we were talking about the first couple shifts of the year. When you start volunteering, they can be particularly, like, anxiety-producing.
Sure.
And I remember there was one call initially that was, like, a younger caller. And we don't have, like, a specific age demographic normally, but this young caller just really stuck out to me, and we were on the phone for quite a long time. It was my longest call since being there. And she was just, like having, like, lots of general anxiety like I do, and just putting myself in her situation. I didn't talk much, honestly. I just kind of listened, but I felt like I was effective. And the call ended pretty well. So that call kind of, like, boosted my morale.
Confidence builder.
Yeah.
What about you, Ian?
So being there for 15 months, I've taken a lot of calls, but there are definitely people who I have felt the listening ear has saved their life in a sense, and I more or less have been told that by certain callers. So anytime where I really feel like I'm making a difference in someone's life, or anytime someone thanks me for being there for them, I think I feel really, just really good for being there.
Mm. Carly, what would you say to someone who's maybe considering becoming a volunteer, but might be hesitant over just the nature of the work and the responsibility?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm not going to lie. It is challenging. The training in particular is very challenging. It kind of surfaces like on any emotions that you've ever had, honestly. But I would say it's worth a shot. Like Ian said, we give everyone a chance, mm-hmm. and it really highlights your strengths emotionally. And if you even have the slightest interest to join the year, I would highly recommend it, because I think it could be very beneficial to you and to our community at the year.
Oh, how can people learn more, Ian?
So we have a website. If you go to www.theear.org, we have information on there. And then you can also call us. Our number is 517-337-1717. We're 24 hours. So if you do have any questions about what we do or wanting to get involved, you can call us anytime and check us out.
Number hasn't changed since 1969, if I'm not mistaken. I remember
correct.
Learning that number a long, long time ago. I've been speaking with Ian Jacobs, Recruitment and Orientation Director of the Listening Ear, and Media Liaison Director Carly Geraci. Ian, Carly, thank you for being here. Continued success at the Great Listening Ear.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And Current State is looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action feature. Please help us out and email us your suggestions to currentstate@wkar.org. Please put Neighbors in Action in the subject line, or tweet us @KARCurrentState. Tell us a little bit about why you think they should be featured for the work they do. Well, a century ago, Michigan passed a law that would enact statewide prohibition. The Damon Act would take effect 3 years before national prohibition. And we all know what the booze ban led to: smuggling, speakeasies, and an organized crime free-for-all. Few criminal groups were as ultra-violent as Detroit's infamous Purple Gang. The Purples were Detroit's most notorious gangsters in the 20s and 30s. Led most often by members of the Bernstein family, the Purple Gang was made up of immigrants from Detroit's Lower East Side. Detroit native Daniel Waugh is fascinated with the history of Midwest organized crime. He's authored numerous works on the subject, including the book Off Color: The Violent History of Detroit's Notorious Purple Gang. WKAR's Peter Wharf caught Dan by phone yesterday. He leads off the conversation by recalling the roots of the Purples' colorful early history.
The two oldest brothers, Abe and Joe, were born in Russia just before their family set sail for America in the early 20th century. When alcohol was outlawed in Michigan in 1918, the Bernsteins were still in grade school at that point in the Jewish neighborhood of Detroit, which was known by the press as Little Jerusalem.
Right.
They basically hung out in the streets and they're just getting into trouble and causing mischief. And as they grew older, they grew into more serious crimes like armed robbery and assault and such. But there was a significant amount of older Jewish American criminals that were present in the neighborhood at the time that the Bernstein brothers were passing through adolescence. Almost all of them were transplants from the underworld of the Lower East Side of New York. It was these older men who first started bringing in alcohol across the river from Canada. And once the Bernsteins grew up, they were the ones who took over the business from the older ones, the older mobsters. One's name was Joe Murphy. Well, he wasn't Irish, but nobody seemed to remember his Jewish birth name.
Right.
Abe Bernstein was a couple years older than Joe, Ray, and Izzy, the other Bernstein brothers. And he initially worked as a newsboy when he was a young kid. And after he dropped out of school, he worked for Ford Motor Company for a few years in an assembly plant. But around 1913, Abe Bernstein started working in a downtown Detroit gambling house called the Dresden Cafe, which was apparently a real slaughterhouse. It was run by a former Detroit alderman by the name of Eddie Barnett. It was here that he got introduced to his lifelong love, which would be gambling. And he also learned the rudiments of the underworld and just generally learned how to be a tough customer, if you will.
This is Peter Wharf for Current State on WKAR. I'm speaking with Dan Waugh. He's author of the book entitled Off Color: The Violent History of Detroit's Notorious Purple Gang. Now, right there in the title of your book, Dan, Off Color, that is associated with the name Purple Gang. Will you talk about how Off Color suggests this idea of Purple Gang?
Yes. The term off-color originated with a Detroit news story that was printed on April 1st, 1928, right after a number of members of the Purple Gang had been arrested for a bunch of terrorism in the cleaning and dyeing industry. And this story suggested that while these young kids were growing up on Hastings Street, they robbed a series of pushcart owners on the streets. These pushcart vendors would sell fruits, vegetables, sundry items. And apparently after one pushcart owner had been victimized by these young kids who would grow up to be the Purple Gang, he complained to his friend. He said, "Those kids are just rotten, like the color of bad meat. They're off color. They're a Purple Gang." It's my opinion that this story is almost certainly an invention of the author who wrote the article back
right
in 1928.
Yeah.
But it was very colorful and very catchy, and it kind of stuck. And I used that term in my title.
Yeah, like so many names, who knows if the stories from which they arose are true, but it does make for a great story. Dan, tell me about once the Purple Gang really begins to take hold, What are the rackets that they get into?
At their Zenith Purple Gang, they were essentially jacks of all crimes. There wasn't, in fact, I even say in my book, there was not a felony they wouldn't commit. In addition to bootlegging, they were really big on hijacking. While the Purple Gang smuggled some booze across the river from Canada, by and large, just about all the alcohol they trafficked in was stolen from somebody else. They'll let somebody else do the hard work of smuggling across the river, and then once they do, they'll steal it from them right there on the water.
Oh, okay. Right.
And they also were very big in extortion. They got involved in the cleaning and dyeing industry here in Detroit and extorted those cleaning plants and the cleaning owners for a good 3 years. It resulted in at least two murders and hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of damage. They were very big in narcotics smuggling. They were one of the biggest suppliers of opiates, namely heroin, morphine, and opium in Detroit in the 1920s and 30s. They were also involved in contract murder.
Right.
There's a very popular theory, which I personally don't subscribe to, that they were involved somehow in the infamous St. Valentine's Day Massacre in Chicago.
This is Peter Whorf for Current State. I'm speaking with Daniel Waugh. He's author of the book entitled Off Color, The Violent History of Detroit's Notorious Purple Gang. And we're associating this piece of history along with the Damon Act, which we talked about a little bit earlier in this conversation, which goes back 100 years ago. We're also talking about some of the high-profile incidents with which the Purple Gang was associated. Tell us about the Miraflores Massacre.
The Miraflores Massacre came about as a essentially as the result of two murders. One of the Purple Gang's main distributors was a fellow by the name of Johnny Reed. Johnny Reed moved to the Detroit-Toledo area around the time of World War One. Not coincidentally, you know, about the time that the Damon Act took effect in Michigan. Around 1921, Johnny Reed was shot in the head five times in New York City and miraculously survived, although he lost one of his eyes. He had a reputation as being a real tough customer, an unkillable customer,
I would say.
In the mid-1920s, Johnny Reed got into a shooting war with a rogue Sicilian gangster by the name of Mike DePisa. Mike DePisa was kind of a very incompetent gangster. He wasn't that tough of a guy. I mean, he was something of a coward. And the shooting war, Johnny Reed killed a number of DePisa's men and essentially made him beg for his life. It turned out that towards the end of 1926, one of Mike DePisa's brothers was killed in a robbery of a roadhouse in what's now Macomb County, Michigan. DePisa thought that Johnny Reed was responsible, you know, as his nemesis, so he had Johnny Reed killed in the back of his apartment building on Christmas night, 1926. Johnny Reed's pals were a number of St. Louis gangsters who hung around him and did side work for the Purple Gang, one key of whom was a gangster by the name of Fred Killer Burke. And so Burke went to the Purples, who employed Johnny Reed, in order to get revenge for their murdered friend. The trigger man who was believed to have killed Johnny Reed was a Chicago gangster by the name of Frank Wright, who was a jewel thief, a gunman, and a gambler. He was a pretty hard case, and Mike DePisa was believed to have hired him to get rid of Johnny Reed, his nemesis. So in March of 1927, Fred Burke and the Purple Gang lured Frank Wright to an apartment house called the Miraflores Apartments on Alexandrine Street in Detroit. And Frank Wright shows up there with two of his pals as backup, and they knock on the door, nobody's there, and they turn to leave, and then the fire escape opens, and then machine gun fire starts spewing out of that door and mows them all down right there in the hallway. And it turned out to be the first time that a Thompson submachine gun was used in the Detroit underworld, and the Purple Gang is credited with that.
The Chicago typewriter.
Right.
Dan Waugh is author of Off Color, The Violent History of Detroit's Notorious Purple Gang. Dan, thanks a lot for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
For Current State, this is Peter Whorf.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, the East Lansing School Board is again bringing in outside speakers to facilitate talks about sex education. The district was criticized last year when it contracted with a service organization that counsels pregnant women against abortions. East Lansing parent and author Alice Drager weighs in on these developments, and we'll talk about her new book as well. Plus, lovers of the ukulele will gather again in Lansing this weekend for Mighty Uke Day. It's actually 3 days of music in Old Town. We'll talk with organizer Ben Hassinger and musician Marlo. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Peter Worf is our program's executive producer. Katie Cook directed the program today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, and to Drew Hill. The Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget, we're on Twitter, at KAR Current State, and on Facebook, Natch Current State from WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great day. It's Current State from WKAR.